Vermont Viewpoint is a public affairs program produced and funded by WDEV and the Radio Vermont Group. We welcome listener feedback. Email your comments to vtviewpoint@radiovermont.com.
Good morning. This is Vermont Viewpoint on WDEV. I'm Rick Sengary. Talk about a wild ride this morning. We'll be name-dropping early today. People like Bob Hope, Gene Shalit, and Johnny Carson. Next, we'll check out a neat history project in the farthest northeast corner of the state. After that, we'll meet a woman who owns a business that involves draft horses and hauling trash. And we finish hearing about a book written by a Vermont author that the New York Times has raved about. But let's start with a cautionary tale. If you call into the station for any reason, you have an excellent chance of winding up as a guest on this show. Case in point, our first guest this morning, his name is Guy Ludwig Laudisi, but around Sugarbush, everyone knows him as Luddy. He could fill up several hours of the show with his great stories, but we've got to get him out on the slope, so we're only going to take a half hour of his time this morning. Luddy, welcome to Vermont Viewpoint.
Well, Mr. Sengary, just a minute. I'm just about done munching on my bologna slice so I can put it on my face here like Ms. Mitchell and Mr. Cattell were talking about because there's going to be a lot of bologna in the next half hour.
That's so true. All right. That is Luddy. And listeners, to ask him about his career in radio and television, you can give us a call at 802-244-1777, 877-291-8255, or you can also email vtviewpoint@radiovermont.com. I have ridden...
This bologna is good.
It is good. I have ridden Shotbun in the Oscar Mayer Wienermobile before, just to, you know.
Really?
Oh, gosh,
that
yes.
That's a wonderful machine.
It is indeed. All right, yeah. Luddy, I want you to tell us how you got started in the entertainment industry.
Well, all right. The easiest way to describe this, I was born and raised in New York City, and I wanted to sing and dance on Broadway. And the only challenge with that, aside from the fact that my parents were horrified, was I had no talent. But I was indulged by my folks, and they found me an agent, and they sent me out. My legal name is Ludwig Laudisi, and we got nowhere because I had no talent. And my agent, who had a made-up name herself, Lola Bishop, said, maybe we'll change your name. That must be what it is. Ludwig Laudisi. That's kind of a tongue twister.
It is.
So we'll send you out as Guy Ludwig. We'll take your middle name and your first name and reverse it. And I still had no talent, but people must have been confused because I went out and I got a couple of commercials. And in those days, the late 50s, early 60s, there was a lot of commercial filming for television in New York. And when you're a kid, you're 6 or 7 years old, you wind up, or any actor, you sit on the set while everybody else works all day. So I looked around knowing I had no talent, and I watched the lighting directors, the makeup people, the director, and the producer. Well, the producers seem to have no talent at all. So I said, that's what I'm going to pursue. And that sent me in a direction over the next 20 years.
I got to know what kind of TV commercials you starred in and if you can still recite any of your best lines.
Oh, Rick, first of all, my debut was for General Mills Banana Wackies. The whack, whack, wacky is cereal from General Mills. There's a winner.
Yeah.
But I did a lot of, one-line things. I'd walk into a room, pick up a newspaper, and say, war on cavities? Another biggie was a chorus was singing. General Electric makes it. And I said, gee, easy to take the greatest pictures in the world when we had flashbulbs.
And so you said you had no talent. Come on.
No, that's right. And I remember the director of that commercial said, kid, mend shoes. Do something other than this. But anyway, we went.
So you got into radio in high school and college. Tell us a little bit about that.
Well, I loved radio, Mr. Sangari, and I'm just going to stop for a second to say that it's a pleasure to talk to you this morning, having listened to you recently on WDEV, but in a number of on a number of the other stations around the area. And it really is a pleasure to meet you in this way, and I've enjoyed your career. Perhaps like you, I always loved radio.
Yeah.
And the oral medium. So I was also interested in how they made records. Mm. And as a kid living in New York City, the one part of the arts that my parents liked, they collected records. And on the back of the records, there were the addresses of the record companies, 51 West 52, Columbia, 1133 Avenue of the Americas, or East 24th Street for RCA Victor. And I wrote the record companies and also wrote radio stations and said, can I please come in and see how you do radio and or make records? And as a result of this, I got to know a bunch of people, really by the time I was 13 or 14, and of course began begging to come in and do something, sweep up, clean the control room glass, anything. And over time, I was given a number of opportunities to work at local radio stations in New York City. I was at what we called in those days a beautiful music, yeah, or dentist's office station, WTFM, mm-hmm, along the Long Island Expressway. On the weekends, I worked at WOR, which was, yeah, a big radio station in New York. And eventually, I became associated, even in high school, with NBC Radio. And NBC became my home for most of my broadcasting career, both in radio and television.
Hmm. If only you had an effervescent and outgoing personality, you would have gone far. All right.
That worked against me a lot. I was associated for many years with Gene Shalit. And Mr.
Now explain how. Explain how before you talk about Gene.
Well, I've got to get to my laugh line, Rick.
All right.
Hold on here. So Mr. Shalit and I had the same broadcasting mentor, just by accident, a legendary director named Danny Sutter. Danny was also loquacious, as I guess you gathered I am.
Mm-hmm.
And one day, Gene leaned back in his chair, looked at me, and he said, when you and Danny are in a room and you have a conversation, who listens? So, anyway.
Brilliant.
What was your question?
Well, so how'd you get into TV to begin with then? Because you went from radio to TV.
Well, I was in radio and television in Toledo, Ohio. My parents sent me to the University of Michigan because it was as far away as they could get me. You know, my father said, your mother and I wanted children. Imagine our disgust when you came along. But anyhow, I graduated from the University of Michigan, and my first real job was at an NBC affiliate. By real job, I mean after college, adult job.
Sure.
And it was WSPD was both a major regional radio station affiliated with NBC and NBC Television. So my job, the so-called executive producer of the station, had me dabbling on both sides. Loved radio, but got a chance to sample television and begin to play in television. And while in college, I also did some work there, and I had done commercials in television. So there's sort of my love was radio, and I wanted to try and earn a living in radio, but television kept pulling. And I would say the first real significant transition was I had pitched a series of radio specials at NBC, 2 hours in length, in the early 80s. And Johnny Carson became interested in them to shorten the story and found me. I was 27 years old. And as a result of those radio specials, I became involved both with The Tonight Show, with some of Johnny's specials at NBC, and also with the work of Mr. Hope, Bob Hope, whom Johnny took me to. And that connected me more to television. And then in the middle 80s, I went to work for the American Broadcasting Company, ABC. And once again, like in Toledo, I was working for both the radio side, WABC Radio and WPLJ, and Channel 7, WABC, the local ABC television station. So more and more dabbling in television, and then eventually the radio people got sick of me and said, go to television completely. And that coincided with friends and colleagues from NBC asking me to return to NBC and the Today Show.
Wow.
To perhaps help them become a little bit more competitive in the marketplace. That was in the late 80s. And as a result of that, we built the Glass Studio. We invited Katie Couric. We found Matt Lauer and a number of our stalwarts like Willard Scott and Bryant Gumbel and Gene Shalit,
of course,
became so much more important to the future of the show. And it was that was really a golden era, the 90s, for the Today Show into the early 2000s. It was a wonderful time to be there. I was very lucky to be asked to be part of it.
And Luddy, just for you, I got the band back together playing
there
the
it is.
Tonight Show theme just for you.
Well, that's called Johnny's Theme. That's the name of that song. And it was written, the music was written by Paul Anka, and the lyrics, which you've never heard, were written by one Johnny Carson.
No
kidding. And that was the theme from the first night that Johnny took over in 1962 from, it had been Jack Parr's show,
right.
Although there had been a lot of guest hosts, while they tried to find someone to replace Jack Parr, who was considered irreplaceable, and he was brilliant, but of course Johnny Carson is the winner and still champion.
Oh, no doubt.
There's pretty much no one was ever like Johnny, and what an experience to be around him. Now, if Johnny were in the room right now talking with us, his phrase would be, keep quiet, guy.
But I'm sure he said it with respect and love.
Yes. Don't you have something else to do, something to write, guy? Please. Anyhow, but no, a lovely man and a wonderful friend to me for and to my father, who was not in the business at all, but who Johnny checked in on regularly as my father aged. So I'll always thank him for that.
I love it. Now, you switched over to the Today Show eventually. Jeff Zucker, who became the president and CEO of NBC Universal, was the producer there. I would imagine you worked for Jeff. Didn't he want to take you with him up the corporate ladder as he moved up to head of NBC Universal?
Jeff actually tried to make sure that I didn't know where he lived and where he worked. He wanted to be very sure that I didn't follow him. He'd had enough of me. Now, Jeff moved on, as a number of people did, like Katie, and we were sad, those of us who remained, not so much because we were upset about his success, but because we knew he would be successful wherever he went. Rick, I'll just tell you, and this isn't necessarily a funny story, but Jeff is the type of person who could have been a brain surgeon. He could have been a scientist. He was and is extraordinarily smart. And not a lot of us, I'm the living proof, are that smart in broadcasting. You know, we sort of tumbled through school and, you know, were interested in other things. Jeff was and probably could be called a genius. And being around him and being stimulated by his ideas and his constant desire to, for example, do our Today Show better and make it more relevant at a time when that kind of television was relevant. It's less so now with personal devices and the Internet.
Right.
But it's hard to imagine how important a morning news program on national television was or had the potential to be in the, let's say, early 90s. And Jeff pulled out every stop. He used every resource available, even, you know, the albatrosses with which he was saddled, like myself, to make a better program.
He developed workarounds.
yeah, that's right. He had to, you know. And again, and if Jeff were in the room right now listening, he would say, keep quiet, though. But that's another.
I'm sensing a trend. Now, one of the things they still talk about around the Today Show set was when Luddy took the show to Sugar Bush. And before we get to that, when did you start coming up to Vermont?
Well, one of my best friends, Jeff Block, who has spent his career running television stations, he and I were both in New York City in the early 80s. He had come from California. I came from Toledo, where I had been working. And we were both amateur downhill skiers. And as anyone knows who's listening, who is a full-time, part-time, or who adopted these spots, you got to have somebody to make the 300-mile drive with. So we began skiing around the Northeast in the early 80s, and we discovered what Win Smith, who later bought Sugar Bush, codified into a slogan. We found that we were better here. We could be better here in the Mad River Valley. And after really skiing all over the Northeast, we tried to settle here on a part-time basis. And we were lucky enough to find a teeny little house, which first we leased, and then I bought with my wife, and we have been here ever since. So I would say we started coming to Sugar Bush as visitors in 1980. We came seasonally starting in 1982, and we went year-round, full-time part-timers, as I call it, in January of 85. Mm. So we've been here since then.
Wow. Now tell us about the Today Show.
It's been a wonderful experience to be here, but this house where we still live became a retreat location for any number of executives with whom I worked through the years. And among other things, at the table in which I am sitting sat the team that ran the Today Show. And among other things, at this table, it was decided that Katie Couric should be one of the full-time hosts
of Today.
And that decision, I think, I want to say that was made maybe in 91. It might have been 90, 92. I'm old, Rick. I can't remember anymore.
But right there at the Luddy table.
Yeah, at the Luddy table.
Yes. I love it. Now, I want
and
you to tell
us. And if the people sitting at that table were here right now, they'd say, keep quiet, guy. But anyhow.
I'm the only person who doesn't say it. I want you to talk now. We're on radio. Now, tell us about the Today Show at Sugar Bush. First of all, your idea?
No. No. I'm not good at stuff like this. But my wife and I were attending an event at Sugar Bush shortly after Mr. Smith, Win Smith, who was then the owner, had rebuilt the base area, and he built the wonderful Gatehouse Day Lodge and the Claybrook. It's a hotel, a residence, and a restaurant, so kind of one big building that houses many functions. And we were staying at Claybrook because our house was being repaired, and we had to walk across this lovely plaza that exists between Claybrook and the Gatehouse Lodge, where a dinner we were attending was to be held. And Beverly stopped and said, this would make a great place to do a television show, maybe today, because it's a big open area with lovely views.
Yeah.
And I said, Beverly, you're a second-grade school teacher. You don't know nothing. And then I went back to New York, and I said, hey, guys, what do you think about the Today Show? And they said, Luddy, you're our worst producer. We don't want to listen to you. I said, well, Beverly thinks. We said, oh, we're going to go up and take a look then. That'll be great. If Beverly likes it, we're going.
There you go.
And so it really was Beverly who was the initial person behind it, and that we have a production manager is the best way to describe it, Evan Klupp, still there, brilliant, And Evan and his team came up, and he said, we can do something here. Hmm. And our broadcast from Sugarbush in 2008, February of 2008, was one of the highest-rated programs in the history of morning television, and was wonderful for us. And also, I'm told, it worked out pretty good for Sugarbush. So that was a lovely thing on both sides.
Wow. Congratulations, Beverly. We've got about a minute and a half left, but this wouldn't be, you know, a full interview because if I didn't ask you about this, speaking of success, you have been named to the Sugarbush Wall of Fame. I want to congratulate you. How did that happen?
Well, now, Rick, you know, being in the news business, you know, you heard a lot of talk about a fraudulent election and fraudulent results.
Yes, indeed.
Apparently, the fraudulent election took place with me at the Hall of Fame, or Wall of Fame, as they call it. I'm on that wall with two true legends, Siggy Grottendorfer, who is arguably one of the best ski school directors in the history of North American skiing, and Henri Borel, who not only invented ski area and ski hospitality, but also introduced America to the discotheque. Mm. Just another one of the things that Henri did. So there had to have been a miscalculation of votes for me to be there. But I will say that I was very honored to be not only with them, but some true pioneers who were up there on that wall. And, you know, I just hope that somebody doesn't graffiti me, because they know I really don't belong with a group of legends like the others, and especially my two.
You got 10 seconds to explain what reason they've given for putting you up on the wall.
Well, I think it might have had something to do with helping Sugarbush get on the Today Show. And maybe being
which was Beverly's
promoted
idea.
Through the years of the Valley.
Yeah, all right.
Perhaps.
Which was Beverly's idea. All right, Guy Ludwig, Luddy Ladisi, has done it all, and then he wound up on this show. And we're glad he did. Luddy, thanks for being on with us this morning. Now get out there and ski.
Well, thank you for the invitation, Rick, and keep up the good work. You're doing a great job.
All right, thanks, Luddy. We're going to take a break for CBS News, and we'll be back to learn about some history of Canaan. And coming up today on WDEV, it's the afternoon news service at 4 with Brady Farkas, and then high school basketball coverage beginning at 5:45, Thetford and People's Academy. This is Vermont Viewpoint on WDEV.
Warren Village is a picture-perfect snow globe this time of year. We invite you to visit us at the almost world-famous Warren store. Come for breakfast, lunch, or après-ski. Have a signature deli sandwich, a hearty soup, or a specialty coffee drink paired with a sweet treat from our incredible bakery. Upstairs is a cornucopia of delightful and unique finds, from men's, women's, and children's clothing to gifts, toys, games, jewelry, hats, gloves, and scarves. Best one-stop shopping in Vermont, according to Yankee Magazine. Fun, funky, safe, and friendly. Warren Store, Main Street, Warren Village, and warrenstore.com.
Welcome back to Vermont Viewpoint. I'm Rick Sengary. It's funny how I think of Canaan being at the end of the earth relative to the rest of Vermont, of course. But if you live in that corner of the state, you're right at the intersection of Vermont, New Hampshire, and Quebec. It's only 40 miles from Sherbrooke, which has 160,000 residents. And a lot of interesting happenings there were captured around a century ago and have been preserved on glass plate photo negatives. Dennis Fuller is a member of the Canaan Historical Society. He's been working with these negatives, and he joins us now to tell us their story and the stories they tell. Dennis, welcome to Vermont Viewpoint.
Well, good morning, and thank you for asking me.
You're welcome. Listeners, if you'd like to ask Dennis about the photo negatives, you can call us at 802-244-1777, 877-291-TALK. That's 877-291-8255. Or you can email vtviewpoint@radiovermont.com. Dennis, explain what glass plate photo negatives are, since we really don't even mess with negatives much anymore, really.
Well, it's one of the old forms of photography. Shortly after the Civil War, probably from around 1880 to 1920, it was the predominant form. These glass negatives came in various sizes from, you know, it was just a sheet of glass. It could be 4x5 or larger, and I've found a couple that are not much more than 2x2. And what would happen is they would coat one side of the glass with some sort of photographic chemical that they would just put in the camera somehow. And we don't have one of the cameras, so I can't really explain it that well. But once it was exposed to the light, you had a negative, and very similar to the negatives we were used to with the 35 millimeters and the older cameras before that. Now, of course, none of the cameras use negatives, but these glass negatives that the lady and her husband that did all of the photography, the glass plate negative photography, was they were called the Lunds, L-U-N-D-S. Mm-hmm. He was a lawyer, and she was the daughter of one of the local doctors. And I've never found out why they started taking photography, doing the photography. She had a studio set up on the second floor of their house that they built in Canaan. The house is still there, and that's why we have the negatives. A lot of them were stored in the basement. When they were found, they were offered to the town after other people had gone through them and evidently picked out the best of the bunch. But Mrs. Lund did the groundwork, and I think her husband must have done the legwork, because a lot of the pictures that we have, a lot of the negatives that we have, are taken from a hillside overlooking the town. Hmm. And I can't imagine this poor lady hauling all that stuff up the hillside on her back.
The negatives themselves, you said, are from 2x2 up to 4x5. Are they heavy? Do they weigh a lot? They are glass.
They are glass, and once you accumulate a bunch of them, they are heavy. I hauled two boxes out of the town office, and I wasn't sure I was going to make it to the car before I dropped them. But they can weigh a lot, and of course the camera had to have a tripod.
Right.
So I've never seen a picture that shows their operation, but I've seen enough pictures of them to know that he was taking the photographs and she was always in one of them. So they had to have a way of moving them around. I don't know if they had a wagon, but I don't know that the wagon would get up to the top of what they call Van Dyke Hill.
Well, got to get a draft horse to pull it up there, I guess. Now, you mentioned that these came from the Lunds to the Historical Society. Have you received others?
Yes. A gentleman in Island Pond had a collection that he never said how he came into getting the collection from him. The lady that bought the house was Mariel Ross, Patrick Ross's mother. They lived in the house, and when she discovered all of these glass negatives, I think she sold some, and some had been parceled out to a lady named B. Holmes, who in 1976 wrote a book on the history of Canaan. And a lot of these glass negatives were processed and used in her book, and I think she must have kept the negatives, because the best of the negatives that we've found all came from B. Holmes's house. And every time we go in there, we seem to find a cubbyhole or something or a box that's hidden away in a back corner that has some more glass negatives. So
I love it. How well were they preserved, Dennis? Because, again, glass is fragile. I would imagine scratches could occur.
Right. Some weren't preserved very, very well at all. I mean, they should be stored on end.
Yeah.
But a lot of these were just piled on top of each other, and of course that leads to cracks and broken negatives. It also affects the chemicals. And temperature affects the chemicals. You know, if you get any water or any dust in there, that all affects the glass itself.
Yeah.
So I have cleaned up most of them. You can't really clean the chemical side of the glass, but the plain side is easy enough to clean, get the dust out and any other contaminants that are there.
Dennis, I'm old enough to have had film developed and get the negatives back, you know, with the pictures, and looking at photo negatives always drove me crazy. And yet you're probably looking at hundreds of them. Can you tell much when you look at a negative before you start to work on it and digitize it?
Yeah, you can hold it up to the light and have a good idea of what you're getting into, whether it's a portrait. They did a lot of portraits at Lund's. But then every once in a while you'll see some houses that look, has a shape to it or something around it that looks familiar, so you've got an idea what you're doing.
Yeah.
There are a lot of group photos, you know, family photos and stuff. So, you know, you kind of have an idea of what you're dealing with, and you can pick and choose what you want to work on first.
Should I assume that they're all black and white?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. All right, so give us an example of an interesting image that you have found among these negatives.
Oh, I had one all drawn up here for you. But
excellent.
I've got to find it. Well,
all right.
One of the last images that I found was, it was fairly plain, and I looked at it for a while, and it shows a gentleman standing in front of a monument. He's wearing a long coat, it looked like an old military cap. There's a fence in the back, a split rail fence in the background, and the monument behind him is a granite monument, and there is a picture of a soldier in Civil War uniform, it looks like, crossing the fence. So I printed off a copy and sent it to a friend of mine named David Nelson, who is a Civil War buff, Civil War historian, and he looked at it, and he says, yeah, he says, that monument is one of the Massachusetts regiments at Gettysburg. So, you know, we kind of know where it is, but I haven't been able to figure out who the gentleman was that's in the photograph. And, you know, there's railroad tracks in the front and the steel of the split rail fence in the background. It was interesting, and I don't know that we'll ever figure out who the gentleman in this picture is, but you know, it's one of the clearer pictures that we have. I have other ones. Another one that came up recently was the start of one of the old log drives.
Oh, wow.
There's a team of horses with a load of logs on the back of it and a teamster standing on top with three other gentlemen around and a jumble of logs. And because it's so flat, I suspect they're on a lake or the river someplace waiting for the ice to go out so they can start running the logs down the river.
Mm.
At the same time I found that one, I found one of it appears to be the cook shack of one of the old logging camps. I've spent a lot of time going through this one because I'm trying to date it. And the closest I can, there's a calendar in the background, but when you enlarge it to a certain degree, you lose all the clarity of the calendar.
Right.
But I think it's February because there's only 28 days, so that was easy to figure out. But
right.
As far as the year, I was able to find that there were only 4 years in the early 1900s that had a date with, or a calendar with February 5th was on a Saturday. Kind of narrowed the picture down. But it's interesting because the walls are just plastered with tobacco, plug tobacco advertising.
Hmm.
And there's, you can see two tables with a cook standing behind, or the waiter, I suspect he's the cook. But these are very narrow tables with all the plates and cups all arranged with the utensils, and you can see piles of bread, and it looks like cookies and donuts covering the whole length of both tables.
Hmm.
There's another gentleman there who's either the helper or he's waiting for everybody else to show up so he can start eating.
Dennis, what are you currently doing with the negatives?
I download them and store them on my computer at home so I can sit down in the evening and go through them, try to clean them up a little bit. I have an old Photoshop program that's really slow, but it works some. We're hoping eventually that we can clean up enough of these and produce some decent pictures that we could offer them to sell. I've had two or three people suggest that we should sell some of these photos.
Yeah.
But a lot of them, once they're cleaned up, and I take them down and make a small print at Walgreens, and then we put it on our Facebook page. We have a Facebook page, just Canaan Vermont Historical Society, and we try to publish as many of these glass plate negatives or any other pictures that people send that show the past of Canaan. Some of the pictures go over well, some not so well.
So are you making a print first from the negative and then digitizing it, like scanning it?
No.
And digitizing it? What exactly is the process?
Well, after I've cleaned the negatives, we have a light table that was donated to us.
Mm-hmm.
It's a glass, has a glass top with a filter, and I just put one of the negatives on and take a picture of it with my digital camera. After I've gotten a batch of these negatives processed or taken pictures of them, I'll take it home, download the photos to my personal computer at home. And then if you go to what's called the paint program, there's an option that says invert colors. So I do the invert colors, and it changes the negative to a positive. And then it's a matter of cleaning it up a little bit with the Photoshop program, and then I can download all of those to a thumb drive, take the thumb drive down to Walgreens, and print off a 3x5 photo that we use for the Facebook program. And then if I want to enlarge that photo, I'll go to the copy center in Colebrook, and she'll make me an 8x10 or whatever size I prefer. But it, you know, it's a time-consuming process.
I would imagine.
Because we don't have the equipment to do it. The only place it could do it was in Littleton, and their machine broke, and nobody makes replacement parts anymore.
Oh, no. How many have you digitized so far, do you think?
A couple thousand.
No kidding. How many more do you think you have to go?
A couple hundred.
Oh, not bad. Well done, Dennis.
Unless we find some more.
That's right. And I'm poking to see if people have them so that they can come and bring you more. We don't want you to run out of work.
If they're related to Canaan, we'd appreciate it.
Yeah.
You know, there's so many. I've looked on eBay, and there's millions of these things out there.
Mm. You mentioned earlier, Dennis, that you're afraid some of the negatives are gone for good. Why do you think that?
Well, the damage to them.
Yeah. I mean,
there's a lot of them, are either broken in three or four pieces or more. And some of them have so much damage to the chemical side that they're, you're not going to be able to get a decent picture out of it. You can see basically what the picture is of, but there's no way that you could clean it up enough to process it or print it.
Mm-hmm. Is there specific subjects that you think you're missing that are gone for good?
Well, I've been disappointed that George Van Dyke, I haven't seen one picture of George Van Dyke. He was a lumber baron who spent many of his years in Canaan. Van Dyke Hill is named after him. He owned most of the town at one, most of the outskirts of the town at one time, cut them all off. He was at one time one of the most prosperous lumber dealers, lumber providers in New England. And I've found nothing. I've got, in this most recent batch of negatives, I found a number of pictures of log drives and the kitchen that I was mentioning earlier.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know why there's no pictures of George Van Dyke. It would seem to me that he and his family at one time would have gone in to have their picture taken at Lund's.
Right.
But those are maybe the ones that were sold earlier.
Yeah.
The other thing that I haven't found is any baseball photos. I was collecting information on town teams that played in Canaan through the years, and I know that in 1914 there was a team here, and then they played off and on for years before that, and have not found one negative that shows any of the sports that were being played. And there was also horse races. They had what they called the Trotting Park. George Van Dyke had built it so that he could race his horses there. And there's very few pictures of that. So, you know, I don't know where a lot of these pictures have gone or if they're still buried in B. Holmes' house someplace. I kind of hope so, because we can get a chance to find him then. But.
Yeah. Dennis, this is rather tedious, arduous work. So why do you think it's important to take the time to preserve these photos by digitizing them?
Well, it's something that has to be done, I think. You know, the portraits that we did, we had a couple of eighth graders that came in a few years ago, and we paid them to process the first batch of negatives that we had. And they were mostly portraits of people that will probably never be identified, but they're there, and, you know, they're there for permanent. Every once in a while, I'll run across a picture that has a name, and I'll recognize it from the portraits, and I can add a name to some of these portraits that we have. Mm. But there are pictures of in the original batch that we had. There were negatives that showed bodies where, you know, somebody had died of a disease, and rather than take the dead person to a mortuary, they had the celebration at the house, and they'd invite the photographer in. So we have a number of photographs of dead citizens of Canaan, and very few of those have names. Mm. But it's just something, and I keep hoping the more that I find for negatives, I'm going to find some of these things that we're missing. That's why the last batch that we found had the log drive photographs, which are all unique and pictures that I'd never seen before. So there's always that chance that you're going to find another one down the line.
Yeah, the log drive's an important part of the history of the kingdom in Canaan. Are you enjoying this work, Dennis?
Usually, but after three or four days of work and going through 50 or 100 of them, I kind of tire of it, take a break, and wait till I get enough energy to go back at it again.
Yeah.
But on some of these, a year or two ago, I had a lady contact me that she was looking for pictures of her great-grandfather. And we managed to find some of these glass negatives that we identified as her grandfather, great-grandfather. And then B. Holmes, who was a historian of Canaan and probably one of the most famous Canaanites that we've had a whole bunch of cabinet cards. And all of the cabinet cards that she had were made from the glass plate negatives. And she identified as many of the people in there as she could. And this gentleman that we were researching showed up in a couple of those. So that gave us a starting point, and I managed to find four or five or more pictures of her great-grandfather for her.
Wow, that's fantastic. Dennis Fuller is a member of the Canaan Historical Society. You can learn more about this at the Society's Facebook page. Dennis, this was great, what you're doing, and I want to thank you so much for sharing it with us this morning.
Well, thank you for letting me share it.
Yeah, you're welcome. We're going to take a break for CBS News and then return to learn about trash removal in Middlebury via draft horse. And coming up today at 1 o'clock, it's Greg Hooker in the full-blown three-hour version of The Getaway. This is Vermont Viewpoint on WDEV.
Warren Village is a picture-perfect snow globe this time of year. We invite you to visit us at the almost world-famous Warren store. Come for breakfast, lunch, or après-ski. Have a signature deli sandwich, a hearty soup, or a specialty coffee drink paired with a sweet treat from our incredible bakery. Upstairs is a cornucopia of delightful and unique finds from men's, women's, and children's clothing to gifts, toys, games, jewelry, hats, gloves, and scarves. Best one-stop shopping in Vermont, according to Yankee Magazine. Fun, funky, safe, and friendly. Warren Store, Main Street, Warren Village, and warrenstore.com.
This is Vermont Viewpoint on WDEV. WDEV listener Polly emailed me last week and wrote, "When last at the grocery store, I picked up a free magazine called Four Legs and a Tail. In it is an article about a gal named Macy Ross. Her business is called Draft Trash Pickup. It's a curbside trash and recycling pickup business. The vehicle that picks up the trash is drawn by draft horses. She's located in Middlebury. This just seems so Vermont, hence so Vermont viewpoint. You have no idea how proud I am, Polly, that when you see a story about trash hauling draft horses, you immediately think of me." Seriously. Now it is time to meet this business entrepreneur, Macy Ross. Welcome to Vermont Viewpoint.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
Happy to speak to you guys this morning.
Well, we're happy to have you. Listeners, if you'd like to ask Macy about Draft Trash Middlebury, or if you're already a client, you can give us a call, 802-244-1777, 877-291-8255. Explain first, Macy, what is Draft Trash Middlebury?
So Draft Trash Middlebury is a business that we service waste collection from Middlebury, Vermont. We pick up trash, recycling, and compost now as of 2021. And we do so using a custom-built aluminum dump wagon, and that is pulled by our three Percheron draft horses. And we have about 350 customers currently, and we do it, it's a bi-weekly service.
Mm-hmm.
And so we go around, and we split it up between 3 days and pick up everyone's stuff curbside.
Is this new? How long have you been doing this?
So I've owned the business for 3 years. It's been going on in Middlebury, Vermont for 7 years now. And then it originated in Bristol, Vermont with Pat Palmer 24 years ago, which is how I came about learning about the waste collection with draft horses.
Did you work for him for a while? Or
They used to pick up my trash when I was a kid, actually.
No kidding.
So I was the little kid that was running out with carrots and apples and on school breaks or school mornings and trying to see the horses if I could. And occasionally we were lucky enough to ride around the block on the wagon when Pat Palmer would let us.
Oh, my gosh. So you have three that go out and do the work. How many total draft horses do you have?
So I have five myself. We have the three working geldings, and then I've got a broodmare and a little filly that's about a year old now.
Mm. What are the names of the three that the geldings that do the work, that pull the trash through the town?
We've got Rocky, and he's 8 years old. We have Rook, like the chest piece.
Mm-hmm.
Rook is 8 years old as well. They're the two matching black pair. And then we have a gray horse that we just bought last May, and his name is Chance, and he's 6 years old.
And how old, so, you know, will they continue to work doing this kind of thing?
We don't start them any earlier than the age of four. Mm-hmm. Typically, we like to start them at the age of five once their growth plates are all closed and fully developed. And then because of the pavement, we try to keep them under 15 years old and then try to retire them or slow them down to some lighter work, either on the farm or the wagon rides we do or the sleigh rides. So they have a shorter span on the trash route life just because of the pavement. So we try not to keep them on that too long. Ideally, someday I'd like to have a couple more and keep a good rotation going.
Yeah.
And pretty much minimize the wear and tear on the horses.
Now, I'm not interrupting a round right now, am I?
What was that?
I'm not interrupting a round right now. Is this an off day for the horses?
It is. Yep. They all have the day off. So we did the pickup Monday, Tuesday, and Wednesday this week.
Okay, so what's your day like on those 3 days? How long does a day of collecting normally take?
A long one. So I get up at 3:30 in the morning, and I do my chores at my own house. I have a couple little critters there that need to be fed. Uh-huh. And then the trailer needs to be hooked on and the truck needs to be started and ready to go. And then I head down to the first barn at about 4:30 in the morning, and I feed the first two horses because I don't have my own barn yet. I have two horses at one barn and three at another. So I have to run to the first barn, get the first two horses ready. I typically feed them for a full hour and then harness them, and then they rest in their stalls and eat for the rest of the time. Then I go to the other barn and feed the other three horses, and then get the one remaining horse harnessed and ready, and usually clean stalls at this barn. And then I put the one horse on the trailer, go back to the other barn, put the other two horses on the trailer. So I'll do that, and then they'll all be on the trailer, and then we truck them over to Middlebury, Vermont. I live in New Haven, so it's only about a 10, 15-minute drive.
Yep.
And then the wagon it's haulable by the pickup truck as well. So we haul it into town ahead of time, and then we trailer the horses into town after that. And so then we'll set up the wagon. There's some buckets and bins and stuff that needs to be hooked on. And then the horse-drawn equipment needs to be set up. And then we'll take the horses off the trailer. We'll bridle them up, and then we'll hook them up to the wagon and go. And then the route usually varies. Always depending on traffic and what customers have their stuff out. But usually takes about three and a half to 5 hours. And then we would pick up everything, and then we bring it to the transfer station, the Addison County Solid Waste Management District.
Mm-hmm.
And then we would dump the wagon there. And then we would head back to the place where we start, and then our day is done for the route, but then my day doesn't quite end after that.
You can't just park the truck.
Wow. So then the chores start all over again. The horses have to be unharnessed. In the summer, they all get rinsed off so they're not crusty and sweaty.
Yeah.
And then in the winter, they get fleece coolers or wool coolers until they're dry. And then they go back outside.
Oh, my goodness. Hey, let's go to the phones. We've got Brenda joining us from Huntington. Hi, Brenda. Go right ahead.
Good morning. I used to carriage drive horses. It's a lot of fun.
Yeah.
So my question is, with three horses, how do you hitch them up? Is one in front? Is it a troika? Or how do you do that?
Thanks,
with three?
Brenda.
So we have usually with a three-horse evener, there's an offset horse. So there's the team set, and then there's an offset horse. And we ran that for a little bit with the three horses, but we realized it didn't center the horses to the wagon. It would push one horse kind of off the road kind of constantly.
Mm.
So we ended up getting an evener, and an evener is what the chains hook up to that help the horses pull. And so we have an evener that's evenly distributed to the three horses. And then we have a custom shaft system. So the shafts are like the poles that run alongside the horses, and it runs alongside the middle horse, and then they have an evener or a neck yoke up front that holds the shafts up. So it's just three horses right next to each other as a trika or a three abreast.
Hmm. Now, Macy, how much weight can you get up to when you've got the trailer full of refuse? Are you riding on that as well?
Yes. Yep. We ride right on the front half. It's all open. We're all out in the weather all year round.
Mm.
What was the question again?
So how much weight will they be pulling by the time you get to the transfer station?
Somewhere.
Yep. Yep.
So, about the fullest it ever weighs is about 10,000 pounds. All together. And we figure a team of two 2,000-pound draft horses can pull up to 24,000 pounds.
Okay.
And that's a sustainable rolling weight. And so with the three horses, that really distributes the weight of the 10,000 pounds and makes it pretty easy for them. So, it never weighs over 10,000. Typically, the recycling's about a ton, and then the trash kind of weighs usually less than that.
Does Rocky, Rook, and Champ, do they enjoy this work?
Oh, yeah. They're powerhouses. The Rocky's the one that's been doing it for the longest, and he's definitely realized through the years that you have to be conservative with your energy and not blow off all your steam early ahead.
Mm-hmm.
Champ, the new guy, has not quite figured it out yet. but he's a workhorse. He really, really enjoys it, every aspect of it. He's pretty excited to do it, and they all have their ears forward the whole time. They don't like certain things. Snow plows we haven't really loved this year because we haven't seen much of them. But for the most part, they really do enjoy it, and they like pulling and working hard and getting out and about as well.
What's the reaction when people, especially kids, see the horses coming up the street?
It varies. a lot of them are really excited. A lot of them scream and tell their parents, there's horses outside, there's horses outside. And some of them, the parents don't believe. And some kids, you know, if they've never seen horses before, it can be intimidating for them.
Sure.
Especially our horses with how big they are. They range around 18 hands to 19 hands.
Whoa.
So that's a pretty big horse. They weigh about 2,000 pounds apiece. But typically, a lot of the customers and the kids, they do run out and they get to pet them. We'll stop and I'll stand up the front and I'll let the kids pet them. Something I always wanted to do as a kid, so I honor that when I do this job.
And just for comparison, 18, 19 hands, 2,000 pounds, compare that to something like a thoroughbred or a hunter and jumper.
They usually range around probably 16, 17 hands.
Yep.
Some of them can be taller, but they're only going to range around 1,000 to 1,200 pounds at the most.
Yeah. RC emailed and said dogs. So I wonder, first of all, do you have a dog that rides along with you, or how do the horses respond to dogs on the route?
I can answer both those questions. So my blue heeler, he's 3 years old now, Griffin. He does ride on the wagon with me.
I love it.
Just about every time we go out or anything I do, he's pretty much right by my side. And that's always because he's been the bad dog that couldn't be left home alone. So he's gotten the privilege to work with me pretty much every day.
Wow.
And then other dogs around town, the horses don't really care about them. They're not bothered by them. Most people have them on leash in town.
Yeah.
And so far haven't run into an issue yet with dogs running up to the horses. Here and there we've had some, but they deter pretty quickly. But a lot of the dogs like to bark at the horses. They have no idea what's going on.
Yeah. You mentioned you have 350 clients. Are you at capacity, or can you take on more customers?
So I'm not at capacity yet. There's the route split between 3 days, and Monday and Wednesday used to be combined into one day. But we split that whole route up because it was about 19 miles.
Mm-hmm.
And that was a little too much for the horses, in my opinion.
Yeah.
So I split it up between 2 days, and I can take customers on both those days. Tuesdays are my biggest day, and that the wagon's pretty much overflowing every time we do a Tuesday route. So I've been thinking recently about redoing the routes and kind of evenly distributing the days in order to be able to add customers on all of the days.
Nice. And are you just in Middlebury? Are you thinking of branching into other towns?
So I'm just in Middlebury, and although I love doing the trash route and collecting trash, I do like to have time to do other things with the horses. We provide horse-drawn services of all sorts. So we do weddings and carriage rides and wagon and sleigh, and then I teach lessons as well and would like to get into some clinics this year. So I'd like to just keep it in Middlebury for now anyway. But I do still help out Patrick Palmer in Bristol every Friday.
Oh, my goodness.
but I do not own that business yet.
Well, you own this business. I hope you don't mind me asking. How old are you, Macy?
I just turned 24 in December.
Wow. How does it feel to own your own business? I mean, how do people react when you tell them what you do for a living?
They think I lie about my age, first of all. but it feels really, really good. I never imagined in a million years that I'd be doing what I'm doing now at such a young age. I didn't think I'd own a team of horses until I was 45 years old and could build my own barn. So I'm super insanely thankful for everyone along the way that's been able to make everything possible. And I'm thankful for my hard work that's gotten me here as well.
Yeah.
But it feels really good to wake up and know every day that I work for myself and I do something that I love and something that other people love as well. And my favorite part is just bringing horses into the community, seeing everyone's reactions, and also seeing horses used again for work.
Yeah.
As that's kind of a dying discipline nowadays, more so than ever.
Is there any weather that you have to forgo collecting the trash this way?
Typically, we try to do it regardless. But high winds usually make it miserable. It's too difficult to do it with the high winds. Mm-hmm. If the roads are insanely icy, I'm not worried about the horses, because they have shoes that properly give them the traction that they need.
Gotcha.
But I'm more worried about with how slow moving our vehicle is, about other vehicles potentially interfering with us and not being able to stop behind us and stuff like that, or run into the horses. So really icy, really windy. And then if it's really hot, So far, I haven't had any dangerously hot days, but I probably would postpone it if that was so.
Yeah, absolutely.
And then really cold. If it's really hot or really cold, I just take it easy on the horses. In the summer, we have customers that set out their hoses so we can hose down the horses. And I usually have about two or three stops so they can get water and sprayed down. In the winter, we just walk more and take it easy, so they're not breathing in the really cold air.
Yeah. Let's go to Ripton.
We did it on Monday with the snowstorm.
Oh, I bet. Yeah. Let's go to Ripton. We've got Nola on the line with us. Nola, how are you?
I'm very glad to shut the radio down.
Yeah, turn that down.
To you twice.
Okay.
I'm very well. We're doing okay, and I just wanted to applaud you. I still haven't gotten your name right. Macy?
Mm-hmm.
Macy, yep.
I saw you guys at the dump the last time I was down there, and I wanted to stop you and hug you and the horses and say thank you. When I turned 17, which was thousands of years ago, I told my parents, no driver's license, no car, no truck, no nothing. I'm going everywhere on a bicycle or by foot. And I was successful with that for 5 years till I got hit by a car.
Oh, my goodness.
Killed. And then I realized, okay, you've got to succumb to the wants of society, so to speak. But seeing you down there with the horses made me just think, yes, we can do good things.
Yeah.
And yes, we can.
One tiny little story. We started a garden up here at the Ripton School back in 1993. I put the word out, not on computer, but word of mouth, meet at the school, blah, blah, blah. We showed up that day, and one of our good friends, John, I've forgotten his last name, was there with his horses to help us cut down some trees to make a border for the garden and haul them to the site. What a treat. Just having living things help more living things happen.
Yeah.
And you guys are doing the same thing, so thank you. Just thank you
thank
a million
you.
Times. Stay safe, you know, and don't let the cars get you down.
Thank you, Nola. Oh, that's
be
beautiful.
Well. Be well.
Sounds
so
like
much.
you must get that kind of sentiment often, Macy, from people who see you doing what you're doing.
Yeah, definitely. I hear a lot of my great-grandfather used to do logging with horses or something like that. And I want to be the person that brings the draft horses back. So it's I don't have to hear my great-grandfather anymore. I want to hear my dad or my mom or something.
Well, I know.
I want to bring it back.
Waitsfield and Champlain Valley Telecom, I believe, used draft horses for years. I don't know when they stopped using them, but like to drag, wire through the woods, through the forested area that they couldn't get equipment through. Yeah, but I think that's been phased out. Now, I don't mean to be crass, but when you're out making the rounds, is the shovel always at the ready just in case?
It is. Yeah, we've tried the horse diapers in the past, but when the horses get moving, it just pops it right out of there. So
yeah.
We do have to pick up the manure, especially in the developments with Middlebury being a city, and a lot of people don't appreciate the manure and their dogs eating it. So we do pick it up whenever we can. We like to play this fun game to see if we can catch it fast enough with the bucket, so we don't have to use the shovel.
Well done. We've got about a minute left, but do you compete in any equestrian events yourself?
I've never really competed much with horses in my life. We kind of just had some backyard horses growing up, so I never took lessons or anything like that. But we show these guys at the local fairs. Mm. So we'll do Champlain Valley and Addison County Field Days, and we might branch out to a few more this year. And then my two geldings are trained for dressage.
Oh, wow.
And I just started over the last few years dabbling into some dressage shows, which has been a ton of fun.
Oh, that's fantastic.
But other than that, not really much for competing.
Well, you're busy enough. Macy Ross is the owner of Draft Trash Middlebury. You can learn more about her business, including seeing a great video from this Monday of the horses on their rounds in the snow on the Draft Trash Middlebury Facebook page. Macy, give the horses our best, and thank you so much for taking the time out to share their story and yours with us this morning.
And thank you for doing the same.
All right, take care. We're going to take a break for a CBS News update, and when we come back, we're going to talk to the authors of a very thrilling Vermont novel. And a reminder that coming up today at 11, after Vermont Viewpoint, we've got Common Sense Radio with Bill Sayre. This is Vermont Viewpoint on WDEV.
Warren Village is a picture-perfect snow globe this time of year. We invite you to visit us at the almost world-famous Warren store. Come for breakfast, lunch, or après-ski. Have a signature deli sandwich, a hearty soup, or a specialty coffee drink paired with a sweet treat from our incredible bakery. Upstairs is a cornucopia of delightful and unique finds from men's, women's, and children's clothing to gifts, toys, games, jewelry, hats, gloves, and scarves. Best one-stop shopping in Vermont, according to Yankee Magazine. Fun, funky, safe, and friendly. Warren Store, Main Street, Warren Village, and warrenstore.com.
This is Vermont Viewpoint on WDEV. I am not who you think I am. No, that's not me confessing to living a lie, but it is the name of the latest novel from Vermont author Eric Rickstead, and it was recently named as one of the best thrillers of 2021 by the New York Times. How thrilling? Allow me to read from page 8 when 8-year-old Waylon Maynard comes home sick from school. "Dad," I whispered, my mouth dry as bone dust. I edged toward his side of the bed. I saw his feet dangling above the floor like the feet of a little boy. I knew he was suffering. This fact was as plain as the shotgun propped against his knees and pointed under his chin. "Dad," I said, and I reached out for him. The shotgun went off. And the story races ahead, careening for the next 220 pages. Here to tell us more about this pretty twisted tale is its author, Eric Rickstead. Eric, welcome to Vermont Viewpoint.
Hello. Thanks so much for having me on.
Hello. Listeners, to ask Eric about his latest novel or any of his books, you can give us a call at 802-244-1777, 877-291-8255. You can also email VTViewpoint at RadioVermont.com. Oh, my, Eric. Where to begin? How about telling us about the town in which Waylon Maynard's family lives, Shireburn, Vermont?
So that's, you know, that's a small town. You know, mostly it's set in the 70s and 80s, so it's a small Vermont town. It's loosely inspired by, you know, I grew up in Shelburne. It's loosely inspired by that town.
Yep.
And, you know, the library that this young Wayland Manor haunts, and the railroad tracks I used to walk, and, you know, La Platte River, and you know, the estate on the lake, mm-hmm. Mostly just the buildings and the, you know, the atmosphere of that estate. There was a barn that burned down when I was a kid. It burned down in the middle of the night, and my sisters and I went out in our pajamas and watched, because it was just across the street from us, and, you know, it was this huge barn fire, and I always thought that would make a great beginning of a novel, although an empty barn's not dramatic, so I changed it to a mansion. You know, it's a small town, and there's the wealthy family that lives up on this estate and sort of has their fingers and you know, their puppetry going on to different people in the town. And as Wayland investigates what he witnessed his father do, what he believed at the time was his father's suicide, and he's no longer sure when he's a teenager. And he starts to investigate, and the more he digs deeper into what might have happened to his father, the more sinister revelations come up about this town and what's going on in this town.
Absolutely. Well, the antithesis of the very rich family is Wayland's family, the Maynard family. Tell us about them.
So, you know, after this happens, you know, his father is either, you know, when he becomes a teenager, he realizes he either saw his father do what he did, which was to shoot himself in front of him, or that was someone else that did that and left this note, which is the crux of the novel. You know, Wayland finds a note at his father's feet that day saying, "I am not who you think I am." And, you know, so he's left with a mom and his sister, and his mom, you know, works two or three different jobs to keep the family afloat. And they're, you know, they're always on the very edge of extreme poverty. And, you know, his mother loves him dearly, and he loves his mother, and he loves his sister who's younger than him and is troubled in her own way. And, you know, he'd like to help her and be that father, but he's only, you know, 18 months older than her. So it's hard for him to do that. And his mother being, you know, having to work these jobs, these double shifts, so that she can financially support her kids, isn't able to be there physically as present as she'd like to be, or necessarily even emotionally, although there are poignant scenes where I try to convey that they both do really care for each other, even though Wayland becomes suspicious of his mother's possible involvement of what happened to his father that day.
Yeah, that day, that incident when he was 8 years old, I mean, very tragic for a son to witness. So what kind of help did he receive in the days, weeks after that incident?
So that's what compounds, you know, what becomes a very troubled kid and teenager, is that mysteriously, inexplicably, his mother within days rids the house of every possession that his father had. Just can't get rid of it, it seems, fast enough, which causes him to wonder, you know, later as a teenager, because he was really young at the time and very traumatized by what happened. But when he has time to think about it later and evidence of what he believes may indicate it wasn't his father that day, you know, his mother ridding the house of absolutely every sign that his father even existed, is troubling, and he never got the help that he should have gotten. His mother just became immersed in, now I've got to, you know, raise my kids and provide for my kids. And she, you know, it's also the 70s, so it's, you know, mental health and, you know, PTSD and things like that weren't as readily apparent or addressed, you know, in the way that, you know, now there's services that are broad and wide, hopefully for people to turn to, but weren't necessarily available, especially for someone broke at the time.
Yeah.
So that compounds everything for him. The only thing he saves is .22 pistol of his father's and his father's cherished books. And a couple other things, and that those are the only things left of his father that remain of his father in the house.
What does stoke his interest in getting answers about that day when he turns 16? And why all of a sudden at 16 did he say, "I got to find this out"?
Yes, so he at 16 he keeps having these feelings of sort of deja vu when he's sitting on the edge of his own bed, the way his father had been sitting on the edge of his bed that day. It doesn't stick with him. He's not sure exactly what's happening until finally he realizes in the passage you just read, my father's feet were dangling just above the floor like a young boy. And he realizes, I'm sitting on my bed. I'm 16. I'm shorter than my dad was then. And my feet are firmly on the floor. So he goes into his parents' bedroom and sits on the edge of their bed, and his feet are firmly on the floor, which makes him feel like this is physical evidence that, if this man was shorter than my father, how could it be my father? And he sort of sits in different ways, and it's like, no, you don't sit on the edge of a bed, back from it. You sit with, your legs dangling at a 90-degree angle from your knees. And so this starts to trigger him. How is this possible? Was the bed different? And no, the only thing, the bed's the same. Was the mattress different? No, I don't think it was. And so it becomes a story of this boy. Is he trying to convince himself that it wasn't his father that day? Because he's been so traumatized that he's now clinging to this as evidence. Is it even real evidence? And you become enmeshed in this kid's pursuit of the truth, even as you as a reader and people around him begin to sort of warn him against pursuing the truth, that the truth might not necessarily be something that's going to solve this for him. It may make things worse.
Yeah, I mean, he starts pulling this string, Eric, and it's one of those things, you don't want to know what you don't know. What kind of things does he discover?
So, he starts to discover that there was a teacher of his that had been at his father's funeral, memorial service, and he sort of tracks him down because he was a friend of his father's, and this man now lives in a cabin in the swampy woods, and his wife is long gone, and he's disheveled, and he looks like he's aged 20 years in the 8 years, and so that becomes very mysterious. And he was there that day. The teacher, this friend of his father's, showed up afterward with to help his mother out, and he starts to discover things about this rich family on the hill, and the fact that, the barbershop that he had always, that his father was a barber and he owned a shop, he thought he owned a shop, but when he sort of goes through town's records, he discovers that, no, in fact, he was renting the shop from, the family, the Vanders family that owns a great deal of property in town, and this all these little things along the way, and he finds out things about his parents through documents. And I won't reveal too much,
no.
but as he goes along, nothing, in sort of that classic way is what it appears or what he thought. And instead of uncovering the truth for a long while, he keeps uncovering more and more deceit and more lies and more what he perceives to be no one telling him the truth. He starts digging himself deeper and deeper into this sort of pit of despair.
And you go right along with him. It is difficult at points. Eric, let's get a better picture of Waylon. He's not the most popular kid who's ever attended Shireburn High.
No, he's not. even before this happened with his father, he was a, you know, he was a young kind of a shy kid, you know, very bookish, you know, and ironically, the books he liked were, you know, the short stories of Poe and Shirley Jackson and, mm-hmm. You know, Frankenstein by Shelley. And, you know, he liked gory illustrations and he's, you know, but the trauma that he's endured has caused him to be, you know, lack all confidence and not be very social at all. And plus he's somewhat ashamed of his poverty, even though it's, you know, obviously something out of his control, but he's ashamed by it and he guards it. And he has one good, close friend of his, who's, you know, quite a bit different than he is. You know, he's athletic and he's outgoing and he has an easy manner with their high school girls at their school, and so that creates its own tension and conflict, you know, between the two boys too, as you know, Waylon brings his friend Clay into his investigation after a while, and also this girl that Waylon is somewhat smitten with, and you know, so there's all kinds of tension there.
Yeah, you really pile it on, old Waylon. You have no compassion, Eric.
well, I feel like I do. You know, it's one of those things where the book, you know, it takes on its own life, and, yeah. And there's times where I'm like, oh man, you know, this poor kid myself, you know, yeah. Where it's like, oh, you know, he's really being put through the paces here. But I really wanted to kind of write, you know, it's a thriller, but also sort of a classic tragedy too, you know, where the route, you know, for escape, to get out cleanly, narrow more as things go on, rather than open up in a lot of ways.
Yeah. You mentioned before it's set in the 70s and 80s, so he doesn't have access to the internet as he's trying to piece this all together. And he goes about trying to piece together clues of what happened using, like, microfilm and birth records. You know, you're thinking, well, why doesn't he? And you're like, oh, right.
Right.
Like, this is how he would have had to do it.
Right.
He's really good at sleuthing, isn't he?
He's pretty good at it, you know, and you know, one of the things he feels he needs to do, since, you know, his father left this note of, I am not who you think I am, and because the house had been rid of every trace of his father, you know, one of the clues he tries to pursue at first was, well, is this even my father's handwriting? I assumed it was. There was this note at his feet when this incident happened. But I don't really know, because I can't remember what it's printed. It's not like, you know, he could find it on a blank check if there was one in the house, or, you know, an old check in the house, or, you know, if there was even anything to find. So he pursues, you know, the town clerk, looking through old town records and you know, looking to see what the obituary said about his father's death on microfilm. And and his friend Juliet starts helping him, and they start discovering things that, you know, he didn't know, that involved his parents and, you know, their marriage and all sorts of things. But it was fun to do, to not have him just, oh, let me just get online and look.
Yeah, I agree. And yeah, he looked for old love letters. Those were gone. So now interviewers love to ask if a novel is autobiographical. And I can only hope for your sake that, that this is not, and it's just a figment of your twisted imagination. So is it the latter, Eric?
Yeah. Yeah. You know, you start with certain things, like you said, that, you know, a barn burning in the night when I was a kid, you know, very dramatic, you know, you feel the heat from it, and it's just, you know, huge hay barn burning in the black night, and that, but, you know, okay, well, that's not, you know, an empty hay barn's not that dramatic, so I'll turn it into a mansion full of, you know, with people in these secret rooms that's burning in the middle of the night. And, you know, there's parts of, you know, that you borrow from or are inspired by, like, you know, I loved the library as a kid, which is, you know, where Waylon finds himself a great deal of the time. And, you know, so those little things and flourishes, simple things like the card system at the library
that
used to be there, and I was thinking about that, like, oh, I forgot they even had those,
but yeah.
I really did love them, and almost like secret code. Part of it was almost like a secret code only for the librarians, and you know.
And Dewey himself, who created the Dewey Decimal System. What has been the reaction from readers about the ending, which we shall not reveal?
Right. Well, they, you know, I feel like I did my job because it has left them, like you mentioned yourself, breathless. You know, just oh my, I can't believe it ended this way. Some people didn't like that. The vast majority really, really loved it, even though it left them sort of like breathless or gasping, like, wow, okay, this was a full-on tragedy in a lot of ways. But I felt like, I did what the book did, what I wanted it to do, and it sort of took on its own life, and it succeeded. You know, it's been really well received. Readers have really, really enjoyed it, and been struck by it. And you know, as you mentioned at the top of the show, the New York Times picked it as one of the best thrillers of the year, and it's had great reviews and critical reception as well, which is always nice.
But after all those twists and turns of like the last 50 pages or so, I really liked how you allowed things to calm down and tied up all the loose ends on the last few pages. Was that intentional as well? I mean, to kind of give everybody a chance to kind of decompress.
Yeah, I needed that myself as the writer. You know, I'd like need to step back here and take a breath and sort of, go to a wider lens, so to speak, of where things are now, where this ended up and what happened to him following, all of the most important critical events of the book and where that left him afterward, type of thing. And I felt it was necessary to have some of that.
Yeah. We've got about a minute left. Are you working on anything now?
Yeah, I'm always working on it. I'm finishing up a short story collection. I have another book coming out this year. Pub date's yet to be determined, but it'll probably be, summer or early fall. I'm working on, working on another novel.
I better hold on tight.
Yeah.
Wow, what a ride it was. Eric
Rickstead's
latest book is I Am Not Who You Think I Am. It's published by Blackstone Publishing and was named by the New York Times as one of the best thrillers of 2021, and they got that right. Eric, thank you so much for being on the show this morning.
Thank you so much for having me. I really appreciate it.
All right, take care. That is our show for today. Vermont Viewpoint is directed by Danny McGivergan. Our email address is vtviewpoint@radiovermont.com. Feel free to suggest topics or guests. And you can listen to past episodes of Vermont Viewpoint by downloading our podcast at wdevradio.com. The Vermont Viewpoint podcast is sponsored by The Warren Store, funky, friendly, and almost world famous. We've got Common Sense Radio with Bill Sayre up next. I'm Rick Singeri. Meet you back here tomorrow when I speak with Bob Ney, and we'll hear about the mathematics of reapportionment.